Jacksonville City Council president says it's time to take down the city's Confederate monuments. And a federal judge rejects former Congresswoman Corrine Brown's request for a new trial. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime or on iTunes. We are streaming live on Facebook right now, too. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, advice on planning for your retirement from Jacksonville's own retirement coach, Adam Wolf. Plus, don't miss it as we welcome the radio voice of the Florida State Seminoles and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Gene Deckerhoff is here. We'll talk to him about his career in broadcasting a little later on. All of that ahead, but first it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome the Dean of News Reporting in Jacksonville, David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union.
Well, thank you, Melissa. Good morning to everybody.
I figure if I can say Gene Deckerhoff is, you know, a Hall of Famer, I have to give you a suitable title as well.
I like it.
Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth is here.
Good morning.
And our own WJCT reporter Ryan Bank.
Go Noles.
Lots to discuss this Friday, but our first story, first up right now, in the wake of the tragedy in Charlottesville, Virginia, Jacksonville City Council President Anna Broche is calling for all Confederate memorials and statues in public places in the city to be removed and placed in museums. She's asked for an inventory of all of these markers, too. The request has already launched a great deal of controversy, including protests and threats against the council president. Here's Broche talking about her decision.
And I have said at the beginning of my council service that I respect that we're all different, that we come from different backgrounds, that we see the world differently, and that's what makes us a great country. And so in respecting those differences, there's still an opportunity to make sure that on public property that we are not honoring memorials that do cause as much pain as they do.
Broche says she's asked Parks and Rec to inventory these monuments, and she's been in contact with JSO in case there's any kind of conflict between Confederate supporters and opponents. Precaution is wise in the wake of the deadly clash between those two sides in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the removal of a Robert E. Lee statue there. Now, as all of this is happening, a group called Take 'em Down Jacks has started a petition drive calling for council members and Mayor Curry to support this plan to remove the markers from public spaces. We begin the hour with a closer look at this. Here's our question to callers. What do you think of Council President Broche's call to remove Confederate monuments from places of honor in the city and instead have them housed in museums? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page where we are already getting your comments. David Bauerlein, let's start with you. Broche wading right into this incredibly divisive national discussion we're having right now over how this nation looks back on the Confederacy.
Right, and it is a national discussion. I mean, this is not unusual that it's happening in Jacksonville. Cities all across the country are having this same debate, and Jacksonville is part of that national discussion. I was surprised a little bit by how quickly she came out and how she basically said that she would definitely file the legislation. So we're going to have this debate. There's no doubt about it.
Supporters are calling her brave, principled, really praising her guts on this. Opponents are saying she's touched the, you know, the third rail of Southern politics. Claire, go for it.
Yeah, brave is the word that I hear most often in reference to what she's doing. You could also say it's a bit reckless. There is a strong contingent of people who admire the Confederacy for whatever reason. They have built up in their minds this false narrative that it was primarily about states' rights, when in reality, the declarations of secession, all the states referenced slavery, and they specifically said in most cases that that was why they were seceding, and that was the cause of the Civil War. Now, when we look at these monuments and these public spaces, when we say that a culture built monuments to something, we kind of are implying that they worshiped these, the figures that are in these monuments. And what a lot of of people believe today is that it's time to take them down. The monuments are symbols of a hateful past and a legacy that is not, it's part of the American identity, but it's not something that we want to exalt anymore.
And we're seeing this happen in cities nearby to us, New Orleans, other southern cities, obviously Charlottesville. Baltimore took some monuments down in the dead of night this week, Ryan Bank. Over in Tampa, the mayor of Tampa, former Buccaneers coach Tony Dungy, are actually publicly donating money and announcing it to pay for the removal of a Confederate monument in Tampa. And so we are not alone in this.
No, and the Tampa example is actually a very interesting one because of a specific law that was passed. They have to kind of raise the funds themselves in order to pay for the statue removal. And of course, much to a lot of people's surprise, they are already close to their goal. And they only have, I think, a couple of days left before they have to raise that money in order to remove it, or it will stay in place. I think from conversations that I've had off the record with some politicians in town, I think everybody was surprised by this. You know, normally when something like this gets released, and there's some tricky issues because of sunshine law, but normally when something like this gets announced, like what the council president has announced, there's some chatter among among her colleagues, among the colleagues that are on council or with the mayor's office. And it seems like this time, this was a decision that was sort of made by Broche, and she didn't really consult anyone else with this.
And of course, we don't know that for sure. David Bauerlein, city council members are weighing in on this, and some in favor, some opposed. It's worth noting that a block of African-American Democratic council members on this body were instrumental in getting Anna Broche elected to office, and certainly we can be expected to see them support her on this.
Well, I think so, absolutely. I think it'll be, when it does come up for a vote, it will be a close vote. And I don't really know at this point how to handicap it in terms of whether it's going to pass or not. But it's going to require a lot of research by these council members because, as Claire said, this is a culturally loaded issue and everybody has their own perspective on it. And there's going to be debate and disputes about even the history. So it's going to take a lot of time and deliberation by this council.
Yeah, it definitely will take a lot of time and deliberation. I, for one, would not be surprised to see someone put up a motion for a referendum, a voter referendum on this issue. And maybe by it through a voter referendum, we could get a real sense of what the people of Jacksonville want to do with these monuments.
Other cities haven't gone that route.
They haven't.
They've just gone ahead and their elected representatives have made the decision. Mm-hmm. Right?
They have, yeah. But does that mean that maybe that is what is a sticking point for some people more so, because it feels like the elected leaders are ruling from on high to get rid of something that maybe the people do want to keep in the places of honor where they are located.
Well, we also have to think about the fact, like Claire mentioned earlier, or alluded to earlier, the history of these monuments. The majority of these monuments around the country were not put up, directly following the Civil War. There were many years afterwards, and many of them were put up during the Jim Crow era. And likewise, nobody voted on whether or not they wanted them there. They were just put there. So I could see that being an argument. I could definitely see somebody filing legislation to compete with whatever the council president files to put this up for a referendum. But this is a complicated discussion because it's thorny, but the history is pretty clear.
And the lines are jammed. Oh, what a surprise.
No surprise there.
It's our Friday roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. The big talker in town this week, and actually all over the country, should cities like Jacksonville take down their Confederate monuments? We're about to have that big debate in this town as Council President Anna Broche has called for it. Let's go to your thoughts. Otis on the north side. Hey, Otis. Go ahead. You're on the air. Happy Friday.
Thank you. I think we have a misnomer. I think everyone talking about the flag. Here's my take, and that's an analogy. If you had infidelity in your family, and then you agreed to get back together, but one of the spouses want to keep a picture of their lover, and you're going to keep it in the living room and in the bedroom, no one would agree to say that is a good idea. The flag represents heartbreak. is a heartbreak. No one, no African American really want to see that flag or any other monuments around.
Sure. And I appreciate you putting it in those terms. I think that's a good analogy, Otis, to sort of summarize how African Americans feel about these monuments. You know, someone said to me yesterday, a woman who's white, you know, I've never really thought about it. It didn't affect me. And, you know, that, of course, is white privilege in action. You know, for African Americans, every time they walk by one of these, it's painful. It's a reminder of slavery, subjugation, oppression, all of those things.
Right. Ron Littlepage, our columnist for the Times Union, has an interesting column today where he writes about some of the historical context that Ryan was speaking about of these monuments didn't just materialize out of thin air. There were decisions made at certain points of time. So some of these monuments were put up in an era where Florida had dozens and dozens of lynchings. And there was a repressive view in terms of racial relationships. There was entering into Jim Crow. It was basically a message that was being sent to African Americans of what the place for them was in society.
And
so
you
go there today, and now we're in 2017, and you see these monuments that were placed in that context still there. Yes, obviously it's going to cause someone to feel a pain about that.
And as you pointed out, Claire, historians note these monuments are spread over 31 states plus the District of Columbia, way beyond the boundaries of the old Confederacy. Most of the markers that went up at the end of the Civil War were memorials that honored just the war dead. They weren't specific to the Confederacy. The Confederacy monuments started to go up between the 1890s and the 1950s at the height of Jim Crow segregation as sort of a way to push back on the call for more civil rights and as a way to push the narrative of the lost cause of the Confederacy.
Certainly so. It was after Reconstruction, and the mood in the South was extremely bitter and angry over how Reconstruction had been carried out. It's worth noting that Robert E. Lee, who many exalt as like the premier figure of the Confederate man, he did not support putting these monuments to the Confederacy up, specifically in writing said so. So, and you know, to think that he would have been angered by them removing a monument to the Confederacy is actually quite inaccurate.
Which makes it all the more ironic. The issue in Charlottesville was literally because they were trying to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee. So
yeah, and I mean, can't we learn a little bit from how Germany handled the monuments to Nazism after World War II? They removed them, and today they don't have monuments to the Nazi regime. And just think of how someone who comes from a Jewish family would feel to see these monuments if there were monuments to Nazism in Germany. I mean, I don't think that we as a people should really support something that is so hurtful to so many of our fellow countrymen.
Lots of people online waiting to give their opinion. Kathy in Ponte Vedra. Hey, Kathy. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Sure. I think that when these statues or memorials are simply decorations and people find them offensive, absolutely they should be removed. I think the only case where we should have them or where they serve a historical purpose, right? Honoring the dead, or in Gettysburg or Antietam or somewhere where they're telling about history, right? I think then it's important to preserve that. But if they're merely decorations, then people are offended, then any monument should be removed.
Thanks, Kathy. James on the North Side. Hello, James. What do you think?
Yes, ma'am. How are you doing this morning?
Okay, thanks.
This is my thing, okay? I hear a lot about these people saying that, hey, you know, this is our pride, this is our Southern pride, this is our history. But when people start protesting about these things against the white supremacists, you don't see these people. You never see these people. But as soon as you start taking down monuments, they come out of nowhere. Two is my taxpayer money paying for these things if they're on public land? I mean, I don't want to pay for this stuff. Thank you. I take my ass off here.
Thank you, James. Keith in Riverside. Go ahead, Keith.
Yes, good morning. You know, these monuments to the Confederacy do exactly what they were intended to do. They were intended to divide us. They were intended to hurt the people who the Confederates sought to continue to subjugate. The history of Jacksonville is replete with examples of this. In the 1940s, there were four places that were not considered suitable for Negro personnel, black personnel. One was Jacksonville, one was in South Carolina, and two were in Georgia. If all you have to do is look at the history, if you put together a fact sheet starting with the end of the Civil War, what Robert E. Lee said, and then just list the facts of what happened here in this city, you'll understand why these monuments need to come down. It is not about heritage or any of that other stuff. It's about subjugating people of color. That's all I have to say.
Thanks, Keith. Some of the callers reflecting the Take 'Em Down, Jack's group. But we've heard from plenty of other listeners, particularly on social media, saying, look, and here's an email from a listener this morning. This is going too far, Nicholas says. Next, it will be change the name of Jacksonville due to Andrew Jackson. What about that argument?
Right. You know, we've had the debate already here in Jacksonville about changing Forest High School's name. And there the debate was that this particular individual had uniquely not somebody that you would want to name a high school after, not just because he served in the Civil War, but because of what he did afterwards in terms of the post-construction era. The issue here is, you know, now we're sort of debating the entire Civil War. And so that's why it's going to be a very difficult debate for everybody. And then there is a question of, where do you draw the line? Do you take down Lee High School? Does that name get changed? Do you take down all the monuments? Andrew Jackson obviously had a history of
genocide
with the Indians. Yeah. So where does the line get drawn? Sure.
When you talk to a lot of these activists, they say, you know, Jacksonville wasn't always called Jacksonville. And there's plenty of places in this country that change names all the time. And it doesn't take even more than a single generation for people to learn the new names and nomenclature of where they live. I think it's particularly easy just physically to change a name of a high school or a building or a road than it is to even remove some of these monuments. So I think a lot of people, when they hear that, well, are we going to change the name of Jacksonville? And a lot of these activists say, yeah, sure, we'd like to see that too.
Lots of comments on Facebook and Twitter on our Facebook page. David, we need to name a school after local hero Stetson Kennedy. Get rid of the Jim Crow names. Kelly, why not honor those who resisted slavery, like Harriet Beecher Stowe? Brian on Twitter, there was a spree of schools named for Confederate figures in the years immediately after the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision. He's right. That's how the former Nathan Bedford Forest High School was named. Kingsley tweets the show, pragmatically, are we saying they should go to the Mosh, a university, a new museum? That's a pragmatic logistical question.
It certainly is. I mean, there's only so much room in museums. They may not want these monuments. So I'm sure there are some places for them. Do we auction them off? And then who is going to buy them? Do we want to take the money from this individual for these monuments? And another question that we haven't really started to talk about as a city is, how much is it going to cost us to remove them? It's not free. And what are we going to do with that space?
Yeah, that's why you see officials in Tampa saying, I'll pay for it. You know, people, private citizens and the mayor saying, here's some money out of my checkbook, I'll pay for this. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, if I was a member of the African-American community of Jacksonville, one of the questions I may have right now is like, well, okay, the monuments, this is a hot button issue, but what about the very real economic inequality and the other very serious issues with infrastructure facing the black community in Jacksonville in particular?
Yolanda in Springfield. Go ahead, Yolanda.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I just wanted to, I agree with a lot of the callers that talked about what these Confederate symbols and the flag and the statues and the naming of the parks they represent. So as a descendant of the American slave trade, I was speaking with a friend and an ally yesterday, and we talked about Confederate Park and renaming of it. And I told her that I don't go to Confederate Park specifically because of that name, because it is hurtful. I mean, to see the rebel flag, it brings fear. And it does exactly what it's designed to do. And in the statue and Henry Park and statues that are all around the U.S. that were erected as a direct defiance of black people's, you know, desire and fight to come from underneath oppressive laws and, you know, Jim Crow and all those kinds of things. So I think it's important that this is an opportunity in history where we can, you know, make the right decision and remove these statues from public spaces. You know, they can go to museums or even to private collectors. And that those are my feelings in mind.
All right, Yolanda, thank you for that. Thank you. A few more calls on this and then we'll move on. Benjamin on the South Side. Hey, Benjamin, thanks for holding. Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. How you doing? I just don't understand it. ISIS, the Islamic State, they also remove monuments, explode them. What are we, just like them? I'm not a racist, but I think that even the pyramids, I mean, slaves build those. Are we supposed to now tear down the pyramids just because somebody's looking at it and gets sad about it? It's history, people. I mean, history is always going to be there. They build it, let it be there. It's always going to be there. So I just don't get it. We don't have to tear things down just because, you know, we don't like it. We don't like to look at it. I understand it brings anger to people, but we're not going to tear down the pyramids just because, I mean, they're the pyramids. That's all.
All right, yeah, thanks, Benjamin. Okay, what about his argument that ISIS is destroying monuments?
Two words, false equivalency. It just, it's not comparable. You can't compare ISIS to activists and city officials in the United States of America deciding that they want to go a different direction with their public spaces. And again, it goes back to the argument of why these monuments were put in these parks and stuff in the first place. They weren't put there to memorialize or remember history. They were put there for a very specific reason.
Alex on the West Side. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I'd like to say I'm undecided. You guys actually made some pretty good points. As a Trump supporter, I feel like I'm pretty open-minded on this issue. However, I wanted to bring up a principle. Everyone says, oh, these monuments are history, this and that. But, you know, I understand that there is racism attached to it. Now, let me just bring up a point. Hillary Clinton's proclaimed mentor, Robert Byrd, is a well-known previous KKK member. I believe Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton herself publicly said, well, you know, that was his past. He's not that. He made mistakes. But he's a man of principles. I look up to him, blah, blah, blah. Well, for the same reason, can't we look past, well, these monuments have, you know, racist ties, this and that. However, there's a lot more, like this history. Can't we be like Hillary Clinton on this issue?
All right. Thanks, Alex. And, of course, he brings up the point about Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, former member of the KKK. You know, Strom Thurmond was in the Senate for many years, was certainly in the same type of camp. You know, it gets at the deeply painful truth about America. We were founded in blood, violence, and oppression. And that is why this is so incredibly difficult societally, you know?
I agree with that, Melissa. Absolutely. And I think at this point, if we had this conversation 2 weeks ago, first of all, we wouldn't have been having this conversation. But now that the national conversation has begun, doing something sends a message and doing nothing sends a message. So that's why it's going to be a very difficult decision for everybody to make. Just saying, well, just leave them up, you know, whatever. That now sends a message about where Jacksonville is at this point in its history.
Well, we will, of course, continue to follow it because it's such a matter of importance for the community. But we do want to make note of another big story this week. U.S. federal court judge Timothy Corrigan this week rejected former Congresswoman Corrine Brown's request for a new trial. Brown's attorney James Smith had argued Brown didn't get a fair trial this year because of one juror's dismissal. This had to do with a controversial education fund called One Door for Education. She was convicted of 18 counts of fraud over it. Here's Smith talking about the case.
You should look out for some motions that we will be filing for a new trial. I can't give you the reasons for those motions, but they will be coming soon, and that will continue to fight.
Okay, Corrigan rejected Smith's argument that Brown needs a new trial, so it looks as though she will stand trial. It's going forward. Rand Bank, you were in court.
We're unsure of whether or not
me.
Smith.
Yeah, she won't stand trial. She was convicted. I misspoke. Yeah, sorry about that.
So she, Right now, she has very few options. And her lawyer, James Smith, who's out of Orlando, basically in a short phone conversation that I had with him, you know, just minutes after the motions were denied, said that at this point he has a single option, which is there could be a motion for reconsideration on the part of Judge Timothy Corrigan. It's unlikely that the judge would agree with that motion because he would be ruling against himself twice, essentially. Mm-hmm. Other than that, she has the sentencing phase, which will begin in November, November 16th, I believe, for her, and her former chief of staff will be sentenced November 15th, a day earlier.
I mean, now is the time to appeal. Now is the time for her, if she's going to have any hope of having that the convictions thrown out, is to get a new lawyer, argue ineffective assistance of a counsel, among many other things, and see if they can have any luck at the appellate level and even take it to the Supreme Court, because there's a really interesting argument there about the grounds under which Judge Corrigan took that juror off of the panel.
Yeah, David Bauerlein.
Yeah, and it really wasn't a surprise that the judge agreed with his decision to take
the
action
decision,
he did.
Yeah.
You know, so it does set the stage for an appeal in terms of how lengthy and how much that can grind on in terms of avoiding at some point going to jail or prison.
So she was convicted of 18 counts of mail, wire, and tax fraud stemming from her involvement in a fake education charity, One Door for Education, telling donors the money would go toward children, but instead, prosecutors prove she largely used the contributions as a personal slush fund. How much time can we expect former Congresswoman Brown to do?
I don't know.
We don't know.
What was it? Over 100 years was possible. I mean,
over
that's
300.
That's not going to happen. But I would assume she would do some serious hard time, though.
And total. And by the way, why do they always come out with these convictions of 300 years?
They just add up all of the.
Yeah. I mean, what is the thinking there? I've just always kind of wondered about that.
18 federal counts. I mean, each one carrying its own amount of years attached to it, and then you add them up. What she's likely to actually get as a 70-year-old woman, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, hard to say. But a few more headlines from the week. If looking at Jacksonville.com, Florida Blue is hiring for 200 positions in Jacksonville. Some positive business news. And Amazon will start processing packages September 1st up on Pecan. I'm in the South now.
Uh-oh.
Pecan
Another
Park
debate here.
Road. I say pecan. Claire says pecan.
No, pecan.
It's pecan. Anyway, Amazon is starting to send stuff out from Jacksonville in their oh-so-recognizable box. So that was interesting to note. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida do people bite the bait off someone's fishing pole. This happened in St. Augustine Tuesday. 22-year-old Alex Turner was swimming near the St. Johns County Pier when she started cursing the man who was fishing nearby and then bit the lure off his fishing pole. Then she swam off. Deputies were called. Turner's under arrest. Only in Florida does a man get mad at his scooter. Chance Ritchie was drunk and angry at his scooter, so he set it on fire. That's according to the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office. Late Wednesday, deputies found a 2016 Taizu scooter in a blaze up in St. Petersburg Beach. The fire caused minor damage. All that was left was a scorched mess, according to local firefighters. Richie walked up to law enforcement, appeared intoxicated, told them he'd crashed the scooter, got mad at it, and lit it on fire. He was arrested on 2 counts of arson and for violating probation. And on a happier note, finally, only in Florida do marine biologists discover 2-headed turtles. The turtle was found by an intern with the University of Central Florida Maine Turtle Research Group while they were performing a nest inventory. That's when they take stock of how many of the turtle eggs have hatched. Have you ever seen them doing that? Well, when they were doing that, marine biologist Kate Mansfield shared an image of a small loggerhead turtle she discovered with 2 heads. Undeniably cute, even if it is a mutant. After taking some photos, the team released the critter back into the wild. I hope he made it out from the ocean, from the nest on the sand all the way to the ocean.
Turtle power.
And thanks to our panel, Claire Goforth, Ryan Bank, and David Barreline. Have a good weekend, you guys.
You too.
Thanks Melissa. Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Sometimes a little bit of history can be instructive.
The first time I had visited them, we crossed the border, and I was just stunned. I really felt like I was in a different time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. America's Greenbelt Towns, what the Great Depression can tell us about today. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Pasadena Convention Center with our guests Ryan Adams, Casey Musgraves, Justin Hurwitz, Mr. Kevin Nealon, also the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and sound effects man Fred Newman, of course. Ms. Aoife O'Donovan will be there. My Song of the Week and much, much more, all right here.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The very best of modern folk and acoustic alternative music tonight on String Theory. Listen to String Theory this evening at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in, find out.
Judges are confirming what listeners already know. The WJCT News team is among the best in the nation and the state of Florida. This year, WJCT News took home national awards for Best Arts Reporting and Best Talk Show, as well as statewide honors including Best Newscast and Best Continuing Coverage. For excellent journalism, stick with WJCTNews.org and 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your news.
Welcome back. Well, if you have a 401k, you're probably feeling pretty good about it right now. The stock market is hitting record highs. But as tensions continue to rise between the U.S. and North Korea, many are wondering if the market might come crashing down. Financial advisor Adam Wolf has some thoughts about that. Wolf is the president of Wolf Retirement Navigation. He's Jacksonville's retirement coach, helping clients plan for their golden years. Adam Wolf, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you.
Great to see you.
What's your take on the stock market right now?
Oh, my goodness. It's, as of yesterday, it was sort of smooth sailing up until this point for the last 8.5 years. But literally yesterday with all the news, and it's a daily blip, the markets were down, close to 1.5-2%, depending what you were looking at. That's a significant decrease.
Right. And are we in a bubble? Are we looking at another big correction? I know people are worried about that.
Well, the way I sort of phrase that is that we're coming off, since the bottom of 2009, 8.5 years of the markets significantly going up over time. And so a lot of folks are calling that a bubble because of these low interest rates that we're in. So I'm in the camp that I think things are overvalued. Are we in a bubble? Things always correct. Mm-hmm. And they always crash about every 7 to 10 years. So we're about due for one.
Okay. So given that, how should people that are getting close to retirement age reallocate their savings and investments? What's the plan for people in that group?
Yeah, there's two different worlds. While we're working, we're saving, we're accumulating money for retirement. And then when we get closer to retirement, we're in this phase of our life where we're starting to spend it, and spending it wisely and being efficient through this distribution period of our lives. So as we near retirement, for most folks, and not everybody's situation is the same, everybody's unique, but for most folks, starting to take less gas, take some gas off the pedal, foot off the gas, and reduce the overall stock market allocation as we get to and as we get through retirement.
And aren't you supposed to shift funds to more conservative investments as you get closer?
Conservative investments, and there's two major worlds out there. There's the whole, you know, investment world with stock market and bond market types of investments. Bonds typically are a little bit more conservative. And then there's an insurance world with fixed or fixed indexed annuities or annuities that protect your principal, or the bank world, which you can use CDs, money markets to protect principal as well. But having some safety in your retirement plan going forward, because retirements are going to last a long time, but you just don't want to have those major corrections hurt you.
What advice do you have for people who are getting close, but they just haven't saved enough and they're worried?
Well, you're going to have to keep saving. And sometimes we look at folks that they may think that they haven't saved enough. And then that you look at what they have in their portfolios or what they've actually saved, and maybe they have a pension, or maybe they can maximize Social Security, maybe by delaying taking Social Security. But for those folks, making sure you squeeze as much juice from the fruit you can is and get ahead of it now and save as much as possible.
Do you advocate people wait until age 67, say, to take Social Security when you can get the maximum amount?
Yeah, either 66 or 67. We are, you know, that's the full retirement age, and people can even take it up to age 70. But taking Social Security at 62 for folks that are eligible may make sense, and a lot of people sort of have to. But when I work with folks, it's all about when do we take Social Security to maximize over your lifetime, and if you're married, your spouse's lifetime, the maximum amount of Social Security available.
Do you generally tell people to wait?
For the most part, but everybody's a little bit different. I have some folks come in, they say, I don't trust the government, I'm going to take it now. And then I have some folks come out in and
they don't think it's going to be around anymore.
They don't think it's going to be around, and I show them the math and they don't care about the math. But then some folks with their health situations, it may make sense to take it earlier versus later. But everybody's a little bit different. But for most folks, deferring it is better.
Okay. So given all of this, it sounds as though what I hear you saying is that we are due for a market correction. That's important, and we need to be watching that pretty closely. Not a crash, but a correction.
Yeah, so a correction is defined by a 10% drop in a from a peak to say where we are today, going down 10% in any major market index. A bear market is 20% or more over a 3-month period of time. So we are due for some of these drops because we haven't had them for so long.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a couple years now.
Are we looking at another huge crash, recession? Some doomsday prognosticators have said that is coming.
I don't think so, because our economy in general is doing a lot better. The banks are shored up, a little bit more. But there's a lot of debt on the household books right now. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of headwinds. There's a lot of tailwinds. We're going to have to see. And for unique folks who are building their plans, you know, it's all about weathering the storm ahead of time versus later.
Okay. We see you on TV every week giving advice to people in this area about retirement, and you're about to launch a brand new segment as well.
Yes.
Can you tell us about it?
We're very excited about our Sunday morning money report. We're going to be on CBS on Sunday mornings, approximately 9:05, and helping folks and educating folks about what we do and different topics for retirement.
This is on CBS 47 here in our area, launching September 10th.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you have a retirement question for Adam, send your emails to questions@jacksonvillesretirementcoach.com or go to wolfretirement.com. Thanks for the great advice. I was taking notes too.
Thanks, Melissa. Anytime.
And we'll be right back.
The news this week has not been good for the country or for President Trump.
There is no moral equivalency between the KKK, the neo-Nazis, and anybody else. Anybody else is not the issue.
There's plenty to talk about on this week's Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour in healthy living, including this recipe for
Southwestern Tofu Scramble.
We always have a great time, so will you, on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical for your safety in a weather emergency. Visit a public library to get your 2017 Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Stay informed with real-time updates at jaxready.com or download the Jax Ready app to also identify your specific zone and important information. Keep your radio on 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by GuideWell Insurance Agency, exclusively serving members of Florida Blue.
If you didn't have the chance to hit a good jazz festival recently, we've got just the ticket for you. Jazz Night is going to New York City for a special summer festival edition of the show featuring the Robert Glasper Experiment. Hear how the worlds of jazz, hip-hop, R&B, and rock all come together to innovate new frontiers in music. That's coming up this week on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, he is the beloved play-by-play announcer for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He's also served as the longtime broadcaster for the Florida State Seminoles. Gene Deckerhoff is also one of only four announcers ever inducted into the Florida Sports Hall of Fame. He's been calling FSU football since 1979, FSU basketball since 1974, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers since 1989, and all sorts of other things in between. Deckerhoff's deep, rich baritone has become instantly recognizable to sports fans all over the state. He's in Jacksonville, of course, because Tampa played us last night, and they beat us. Gene Deckerhoff is here in Studio 5 now. What a pleasure. Good morning.
Well, Melissa, it's good to be here in Jacksonville, my hometown. I was born in Ohio, but raised in Jacksonville, and it's like coming nice. Home. Every day. We've done this 2 years in a row. The Bucks have played the Jaguars 2 years in a row. We stayed right down here on the river. I do the little river walk, and it brings back a lot of memories.
I bet you. And you grew up on the west side of Jacksonville?
West side of Jacksonville, yeah.
Okay, and what drew you to sports announcing? How'd you get started?
Well, my mother was a tremendous sports enthusiast. And since I can remember, my mother was a baseball fan. And growing up, we had no baseball team here. We didn't have the Braves here. We had 3WE in Cleveland, Ohio. You could listen to the Cleveland Indians. And we made up our little scorecards and kept scorecards. I was maybe 10, 11, 12. Uh-huh. And so I got interested. My mother taught me how to play baseball. She was a softball player. And she also taught me how to play golf. So there's where the sports,
that's
the sports angle. Okay. Uh-huh. And then I debated in junior college at St. John's River Junior College in Palatka. And the program director of the radio station broadcast basketball games. Says, I know you can talk because you're on the debate team. Would you be interested in doing radio? And I said, yeah, that sounds good to me. So I got my FCC license. You had to get a license back in the day.
Oh, really?
Melissa, I don't know if you have an
I don't have
I
one.
I don't know if you have an FCC license.
WJCT does, but I do not.
Broadcast endorsed, but you had to take an exam.
Now,
that went away, yeah. So,
what'd they ask you?
Well, all sorts of questions about broadcast, what you can say and can't say and things. You know, and you have to check the logs and do the meters. And so I had a third-class license, broadcast endorsed. I could get a job in radio. Boy, that's great.
Yeah.
Now you don't have to have that, Melissa.
Now you don't
need
it.
That got me into radio. And then in Gainesville, when I needed to find a job, I went and applied at radio stations and got a job at WGGG in Gainesville. They fired the news director, who was also the sports announcer. I knew basketball, so I did my first six games in Gainesville.
And opportunity knocked.
Yeah, there it was. Knock, knock, knock.
And you were off and running.
Yeah, that would have been 1966.
Wow. What do you love about this stuff? What do you love about announcing?
Well, number one, is I like the preparation because that's the hardest part of the job. The second thing is you're always striving to do the best broadcast, you know, do the perfect broadcast. It's never going to happen, but you try to do that. And I've never done the perfect broadcast, Melissa. You probably have,
I wish.
But that's what drives me, I think, to do it. And golly, this is year 44 of basketball coming up, and year 39 of Florida State football, and 29 of doing games on Saturday and Sunday. If I didn't love it, I probably wouldn't do it.
Yeah, you're working 7 days a week.
Yeah.
You're an icon. Now, who influenced you? You know, whenever I talk to guys that do what you do, they always say Vin Scully. Who were your influences? Like who? Who did you look up to when you were getting good at this?
Well, on the airwaves of National Public Radio for a long, long time, a program every week aired from Tallahassee, Florida, WFSU studios. The gentleman's name was Red Barber. He's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he was Vin Scully's first boss.
No.
Yeah, and Red Barber, I had a chance to interview him when Vin Scully was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, the broadcast wing. Mr. Barber lived in Tallahassee, Florida. I worked at WCTV television, and the Los Angeles radio station that carried the Dodgers wanted an interview with Red Barber. So I went to his home in Tallahassee, did the interview, and I'll never forget that day. But Red Barber, his delivery, the way his preparation, he used the Thomas Edison thing. Sports broadcasting is 90% preparation and 10% inspiration. Mm-hmm. So the preparation is doing depth charts, doing your research, reading the press notes, and then the broadcast is the inspiration. So he was one. But Rick Weaver, the late Rick Weaver, probably 15-year voice of the Miami Dolphins. Mm-hmm. Back in the day in 72 when the Dolphins went undefeated, won 14 games, then three games, the only team to do it, I listened to every game on the radio because you couldn't see every game on television back in the day. And so Rick Weaver probably was more influential in my development as a football announcer than any other announcer. So
he was a role
thank
model.
Thank you, Rick Weaver.
How much fun is it for you? I can tell that you're still having fun.
It's fun. You know, Coach Bobby Bowden is going to be 88 years old November the 8th of this year. Okay, he's a spry 87 right now. Just saw Coach in May and have talked to him on the phone a couple of times since then. But, you know, Bobby always has looked young to me, always. And he was coaching, he was 65, then he was 70, then he was 75, still coaching. And I think being around young people, mm-hmm. being around young people and athletes or young college students particularly, I think that keeps you young. And good golly, I don't look forward to birthdays, but I still don't feel
who
old.
Does,
I
right?
still,
yeah.
Melissa, I still don't feel old. By the way, tonight, the Seminole Club of Jacksonville is going to have our annual barbecue kickoff thing. It's going to be right across the street at Everbank Stadium, and it's always a tremendous turnout.
You're going to say a few words?
You got a lot of Seminole fans in the Jacksonville area, I promise
you. You're going to say a few words?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be a big draw.
I'm not going to tell you all my secrets that I'm going to tell Seminole Faithful tonight, but it's going to be encouraging news about the 2017 season.
Oh, can you? It's just you and me here, Gene. Come on, tell
very
me.
Very encouraging.
You can share it with me.
Well, the number 15 comes into play here.
Oh.
But I'll just leave it at that.
You'll just leave it there. Well, it's. I'm so glad you could be here because, as I did not know, you are a Jacksonville native.
Yeah.
It's nice to have you come to this side of the state. Does it feel? Yeah. It's a different feel over here than in Tampa.
Well, when you say this part of the state, this is where I grew up. Jacksonville to Tallahassee is 2 hours and 15 minutes. We visited our parents, Ann and I, we bring our back in the day, vacation was come to spend time with the grandparents, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent an awful lot of time coming back. And even as we got older and my parents got older, we would come to Jacksonville to visit, and they would come. My mother was a huge football fan. They would drive their RV to Tallahassee for every football game. Even when my mom was in her 70s, I mean, this was an
exciting. Wow, so, she was committed.
So it's not that far from Tallahassee. That's where I live. And then now the trip to Tampa for home games on Sunday morning, we leave at 6 a.m. in the morning, 6:05 to be exact.
Uh-huh.
We arrive at the hotel where I drop Ann off at the team hotel, and then I'm at the stadium at 10:45 and broadcast the game. And then after the game now, because Ann is retired, we stay overnight and then drive home on Monday. But back in the day, when Ann had to be to work at 8:15 in the morning, we would drive down at 6 in the morning, drive back that night, get home about 10:30, and then start all over again. But the home games for me, for the Bucks, 4.5 hours away.
Man, you got a lot of energy.
Jacksonville's a lot closer. If the Bucks were just moved, you got a team here in Jacksonville.
That's right, we got a team here. Yeah. I bet you had a lot of fun last night. Now, as you said, people can come out and meet you tonight at Everbank Field for the big Seminole gathering.
Well, this is sort of an annual thing.
Okay.
The Jacksonville Seminole Club is the greatest athletic support organization on the planet. It's the largest of the Seminole clubs in the state of Florida. It's the most active. They raise more money than any other club. So God bless Jacksonville, Florida, and the Jacksonville Seminole Club. But we do this every year, and it's sort of been a tradition to kick things off. And I think last year I said we're going to go unbeaten. We lost three. Year before, before that, I said we're going to go unbeaten. We lost two, maybe. And so
you were close.
Yeah, but if you go into a season thinking you're not going to win them all, why play ball? You know, you got to go in with that attitude. Oh, by the way, and let's see, 2 weeks from tomorrow, it's Florida State versus Alabama.
That's right. That's a big one.
At the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, brand new stadium.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a ticket now, forget about it. You're not going to. The secondary market has gone outrageous. I think even the high altitude where they issue parachutes are going for like $700-$800 a piece. I don't know why, but it's a first. It's a very first game in the stadium. It's a game between two very high-profile football teams, Florida State versus Alabama. It's Nick Saban versus Jimbo Fisher. You'll be calling it. I'll be there.
We got the best seat in the house, Gene.
Got a Bucks game on Thursday night, the wrap-up preseason. I'll fly up to Atlanta on Friday. The game's on Saturday, and then we'll start the regular season. And good luck to the Jaguars this year, by the way. They had some offensive problems, but in the practice that I saw, the one practice, the Jaguars defense is going to be better than it's been. How about Calais Campbell blocking a point after touchdown? He's 6'8" or something like that. The Jaguars are going to be okay.
We'll hold to that, Gene Deckerhoff. Yeah.
And the Bucks are going to make the playoffs this year.
Well, we won't hold to that. But it's good to see you, and it's a pleasure. And I know there'd be so much excitement for people to see you tonight.
Yeah.
He's the voice of the Buccaneers and the Seminoles. Gene Deckerhoff, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right, and that is our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Kevin Murchard is our producer. We always value your feedback. Send emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or download the WJCT app. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. This show rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday, and have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.